Okay, thanks Mark, and thanks Art. Appreciate you guys inviting me today. It's a great session. I just want to start, before I go into my talk today, I just want to make sure that for the sake of full disclosure, I have not been to the moon. However, I can see it from my house, so I'm a little bit of an expert on it. Gosh darn. So anyway, I have to say that because I've not done such things, I come to this whole process as someone who has been a field geologist and who's taught field geology for quite a long time. And I think a lot about how we should be thinking about field geology and how that will translate into the way we think about doing field geology on the moon. One thing I want to stress, for those of you who do field geology, is that not all geology that's done in the field is what most of us refer to when we talk about field geology. Most field geology has to do with making observations. It's primarily an observational science. I'm trying to understand the geologic history of a particular area. It includes things like collecting samples, but it's not just about collecting samples, and it's not just about laying out arrays like seismic arrays. It's really a very deep way of observing the Earth. And trying to translate that into the way we go to the moon and the way we think about doing field geology on the moon is quite a challenge, in my opinion. But terrestrial field geology, as I say, is primarily an observational science. It relies on inductive reasoning more so than a great many other sciences that are done here on this planet. It involves progressively disproving multiple working hypotheses. And actually, multiple working hypotheses, the idea that you don't simply go out to test an hypothesis sequentially, as you do in many other kinds of science, is a uniquely field geology concept. It's something that was developed in the context of making basic observations here on Earth. But it also leads itself to a tremendous efficiency in the way you do science. It means that instead of just working on testing one hypothesis, you're trying to test many at the same time, and it means that you can really get through a lot of science in a relatively short amount of time. So it's actually very well placed to be able to be done effectively on the moon if we can just get over some of the technological difficulties associated with it. Field geology benefits from varied perspectives. We're not very myopic. When we go to an outcrop, we go to a field area, we tend to look at it from a lot of perspectives, and a good field geologist is always crawling around the rocks trying to get another view of the problem. And that's something that I think we need to be careful to clearly instill in people who are going to be doing field scientific research, geological research on the moon. And then finally, as I tell many of my engineering friends, field geology is not just about collecting samples. And so trying to make that clear to all of the stakeholders in this process is, I think, a very difficult thing and something that we have to work on hard. Lunar and planetary field science, and obviously I'm going to be concentrating on geology, but this is not just about geology. It's also about bioastronautic research that could be done on the moon. It's about astrophysical research that could be done on the moon. But the interesting thing about this science is that it permits few or no second chances. You don't have an opportunity to go back into the field if you screw it up the first time. It's something that you have to be very effective at it right from the get-go. And that's why all of this tremendous amount of field training serves so well during the Apollo missions. It requires extreme efficiency when you're in the field so that you can't mess around on the outcrop. You have to really do what you need to do as quickly and as efficiently as you can. Lunar and planetary field science is encumbered by technology. You saw in a lot of the videos that Jose showed that it's not always easy to do things because you're bulked up with all these different things and you're having to mess with it, but it can also really enable the science that one does. And so one of the things I'm going to concentrate on today is that enabling capability of technology, not just the encumbrance associated with it. And a point that I want to make, and I'll make it over and over again here, is that effective lunar and planetary field science requires a collaboration among scientists, engineers, and the astronaut explorers. And in my opinion, that was the principal reason for the success of the Apollo program, because people work very, very hard to communicate with one another, the engineers, the scientists, the operations people on the ground, and all those wonderful astronaut explorers like Jack, who paid good attention to the process as they went forward. So the big question that I want to address is, can we top what happened 35 years ago or more during the Apollo program? And, you know, I think most of us in this room are sad that we've not returned to the moon since Jack was on the moon. But on the other hand, another way to look at it is that those guys were 35 or 40 years ahead of their time. And so the question is now, can we get not just back to where we were during Apollo, but can we do better than we did in Apollo? And I think we can, and here's sort of a roadmap to getting there. First of all, and this has been talked about several times before, is this issue of astronaut basic training. Astronaut explorers, only some of whom might be geologists, as we've talked about earlier, must be schooled in the essentials of planetary field geology. The curriculum must include scientific context. It must include field observation, not just collecting of samples or deploying experiments, but how do I really look at outcrops in the field? How do I really look at landscapes in the field? It does include instrument deployment, and it does include sample collection, but that can't be the only thing we focus on. The pedagogy for this has to emphasize the value of multiple perspectives, seeing things from different angles and in different ways, and multiple working hypotheses for on-the-fly problem solving. Because especially as we move to Mars, and this was alluded to by something that Jack said, more and more autonomy is going to be needed. And so we might as well use the moon as a test bed for the kinds of autonomy that will be needed for planetary exploration beyond the moon. But it's not all just about training the astronauts. It's also about training the engineers who are involved with this process. And so those engineers must understand the challenges of planetary field geology. You can't engineer for lunar exploration in a vacuum without understanding the science that needs to be done. And that curriculum must include scientific motivations and practical goals for lunar exploration. I think we need to bring the engineers who will be working as part of this process more into the fold of being part of moving forward with planetary exploration. The pedagogy has to emphasize the optimization of activities to maximize scientific return while doing the things that they tend to be most concerned about, which is minimizing human risk and minimizing cost, where cost is not just money, but cost is the metabolic cost for the astronauts, the cost of the energy to do things on the moon that are not specifically done by the astronauts, the time and resources that are involved. So we have to maximize those things, but we also ought to be able to maximize scientific return at the same time. And if we can convince our engineering collaborators of that, we will be well served. The third preparation is that I have to say, unfortunately, that we scientists need some basic training in this too. And the basic training we need is that we have to understand the engineering and operational challenges of planetary field geology. There are a lot of things that we can conceive of as scientists that are not necessarily practical on the moon. And so I think we need our own kind of training to be sure that we understand what the constraints are. Our curriculum must include the risk and cost of lunar exploration, this concentration on those issues like metabolic cost and power limitations. And our pedagogy must emphasize optimization of activities that minimize those risks and costs while at the same time maximizing what we care about the most, and that's the scientific return. So toward those ends, FEED has sponsored and NASA sponsored the last few years a whole series of field tests, and Ron Greeley is going to talk right after my talk a little bit about one of these in this particular area in southwestern Arizona. And they're basically easily accessible analog sites. This one is of a low shield volcano, similar to features that you find a few of them on the moon, a lot of them on Mars in particular. And we've been taking people out, not just astronauts, but we've also been taking out engineers, we've been taking out scientists, and getting everyone in the field together to try and understand a lot of the issues associated with this kind of field geology. And it's a wonderful experience. We've run two of these in Arizona, and there have been others that have been run in Hawaii not too long ago, and there are the RATS missions that Drew had on one of his slides that are done as well. And I think it's a very effective way to try and get everybody on the same page and do a lot of this cross-training among scientists, engineers, and people who are actually going to be going up there and doing this work. The second preparation that's really critical is that is you really must design, prototype, and test. You must do the kinds of things that Drew was talking about in the last talk, where you think about how to build things, design those things, prototype them, and test them really intensively, and integrate that testing with the kind of field exercises that have been talked about earlier today. The thing about the Apollo tools was that they were simple and they were, for the most part, effective. Jose's showed some examples of where things didn't work too well, and I'm sure Jack could tell us lots of stories about things sometimes working and sometimes not, but for the most part, they were really effective. And they were probably effective because they were simple. The new tools that we make and the new technologies that we take to the moon can be more complex than those tools, but if we're going to make them complex, we have to make them transparently so. We have to figure out a way to make it in such a way that people don't realize they're using high technology when they're trying to explore the moon, that it's almost like an extension of their senses. And that's the real challenge, I think, to most of us as we move forward and think about using new technologies on the moon. Those of us who have tried to teach field geology using handheld computing and things like that, we've done it for years, and I know a lot of other people in this room have done it, realize how easy it is to let the technology begin to drive the process rather than aid the process. It's an easy situation to basically make it all about the technology and not all about the science that you're trying to do. So it's a tremendous challenge, but one that I think we can overcome. I am personally very enthusiastic about the use of robotics for the next generation of field explorers. And I think that that can be done in a whole variety of ways. An obvious way to do it is the use through the extensive use of mobile robotics. I'm glad we'll hear a little bit more about this today. And mobile robotics can take a tremendous number of forms. These are a few examples of things that have been tested and run or in the planning stages right now. But it includes things that are large robots and small robots, and robotic field assistants, I think, are quite effective on improving this particular process as we move forward. They can really reduce risk. That's one of the basic capabilities of those things. And they also permit a tremendous number of sort of autonomous and coordinated science activities on the moon. And the trick that we have right now is figuring out how to make mobile robotics and humans work well together. It's the same sort of team-building exercise that Gary was talking about before, but how do we build teams of robots and astronauts who are working together well? And there are a lot of people who are working on this project, on this process right now, and I think we're going to make some quick progress on it. Greater surface mobility is, I think, an absolute essential. And I think, you know, it was asked before the issue about how one uses rovers, and I believe that it's really important to focus on the most effective design and the most effective use of it. This is an early stage prototype of the small pressurized rovers that are being thought of by NASA. The designs have changed a lot now, but I think one of the key issues about this is that these allow long vehicular sorties. And it also puts you in a position where you have very easy ingress and egress from the suits. These are in pressure locks coming off the side of the habitat. So basically, if you want to go on an EVA, you can essentially slide into the suit and go off on the EVA in a very quick way. The other thing is that it's possible to do some work from within the rover, and I think that's also a great way to get things done. The idea of using manipulator arms, having a tremendous amount of visibility out of the rovers, and even some of the sort of situational awareness that Drew talked about in one of his slides earlier on. So I'm a great believer in the ability to do science from within these mobile rovers. Another thing I'd like to focus on is this issue of heightened situational awareness, which is something I do think we can do much better than the way it was done in Apollo in this case. And that's going into the realm not just of mobile robotics, but wearable computing. One of the things that wearable computing can do is it can provide you with greater autonomy, much greater autonomy as an individual, and we should be using these tremendous processing capabilities that people have that no artificial intelligence that we know of at this point and probably in the next 10 years will have. And so we need to use astronauts most effectively and let the robotics and let the wearable computing in the suits do the rest of what's going on. So I think this is one thing we can do, is provide much greater autonomy to the astronaut explorers and have them in a position that they're not quite so dependent on the back room back on Earth. That kind of autonomy also lets you do smarter science. It's not just safer, more efficient, but it's also smarter science. And it provides an opportunity through wearable computing to actually provide real-time tutoring for the astronauts who perhaps are not the ones who already have a PhD in geology before they go on to the moon. The opportunity to do that is, I think, really extreme. We need to take advantage of new display technologies and new vistas that you can produce by this kind of situational awareness. These are some images on the left and right that are basically just spectroscopic images, in this case from Mars. But there's no reason that we cannot integrate those sorts of things directly into wearable computing. If we're working on shadowed areas on the moon, there's no reason that we can't see in a virtual way. If we're working in an area where we need to know chemical composition to do the best kinds of sampling, to do the best kinds of concentration of our work, there's no reason we can't do that through the suits themselves. And so I would very strongly agree that as we go through the next suit design process, it's really imperative to have scientists directly involved with the process of developing those suits to try and come up with the best way to do situational awareness in the field. One thing that we're involved in a lot at ASU, this is a project that is in collaboration with David Newman's group at MIT and with folks out at JPL. And this is literally, in Wynn Burleson, who's also at ASU, but this is really an opportunity to go out and understand how we do EVA planning and simulation in real time so that we can minimize metabolic costs, we can maximize safety, we can maximize scientific return at the same time, and constantly update and change EVA routes in real time so that we can get the best science the most safely under those circumstances. We also think a lot, this room's a little bit bright so you can't see it too well, the two images on the left are actually avatars so that we can do direct simulations of human-robotic interaction on the moon in these kinds of simulated EVAs at one time. And on the lower right-hand corner is an example of some of the sort of high-level sort of realistic displays that we can have of lunar situations. In this case, that's Hadley Rill in the background below, in sort of a surrounding environment. So there's a lot of ways that we can do simulations, not necessarily just in the field, simulations of real-time planetary exploration. So last, I want to talk a little bit about my perspective of a process map for planetary field science. And in my own contrarian way, this all goes counterclockwise in this diagram. But I'd start out by this issue over here on the left of defining scientific goals. So if you think about the way we might do planetary exploration, first we define scientific goals. Second, we select targets. Third, we plan, we train, we program the way we're going to go about the process, conduct the mission, and then finally monitor the outcomes. And pretty much this was the Apollo model, right? That's the way we went during Apollo. And after we monitored the outcomes, well, then here comes the next Apollo mission, and we rotate through that position. But I think in the next generation of lunar exploration, we're going to be able to do this in real time and constantly update and constantly change this process in a recursive way on site, so that we'll be able to define the goals, go through all these, monitor outcomes, and then continually refine the goals so that we can do the best possible science and really focus in on trying to get somewhere with it. The other thing I just want to emphasize once again is that this is all an operational process in this particular map. But on the other hand, so many of these things require direct science input and direct engineering input as well, and that's what the two colors mean in this case. So everything, maybe except for defining and refining those science goals, is really something that's a collaborative effort among the people who are doing the work, the scientists, and the engineers that are the implementers, that are people who make it happen. So the takeaway messages from today. First, 21st century planetary field science can be improved by integrating new technologies. I firmly believe that, and the challenge to us is to just figure out a way to make those new technologies work as effectively as we can. Part of that means that we have to take care to avoid adding complexity just because we can, because we can certainly do things in a much more complicated way than they did them during the Apollo program. What we have to do is make the experience better from a scientific point of view and make the experience safer for the humans that we send back to the moon. What we have to do must be transparent. Effective preparations for lunar exploration require recursive efforts among scientists, engineers, and astronaut explorers, not sequential efforts, and certainly not parallel efforts where the engineers are not talking to the scientists or not talking to the astronauts until it's too late. Here's what you do. I think it's really critical that everyone work together. And then finally, new enabling technologies could revolutionize terrestrial field geology as well. I think it's important to think about going in the opposite direction with us, and I look forward to the day that we can start integrating some of these technologies and some of these methods into the kind of field geology we teach to terrestrial scientists. So thank you very much for your attention, and I'm happy to answer questions.
We have time for just one question for Kip. We're running a little behind here, so anything for Kip? Clive. Yeah.
I shudder.
That's a very nice tie, Kip.
Thank you.
With regards to the complexity issue, have you considered how much redundancy that would be optimal in order to make sure that we get those observations? And I'm thinking here in terms of sorting missions, similar to Apollo, where we probably aren't going to go back to that one side.
Right. Well, I'm not 100% sure what you mean by that. I mean, do you mean in terms of the new technology not working, or do you mean it? Okay. No, I think that's right. I think you do have to have redundant. I think you have to be able to do this if everything fails. Okay. I mean, I think because the science, in my opinion, the science is mission critical. So you have to make sure that you can do it even if the technology fails. And in fact, that's what we do when we teach field geology. We use all this technology as well. You better take a map with you. So I think I think that that's a really good point, a really critical point. And I think that we almost certainly need redundancy with the technology, but we also need redundancy in terms of the basic old fashioned way of doing things.
I don't know if we have time.
Quick one here, just real quick.
Just a comment is that engineering science dialogue has to happen right at the start.
It needs to have happened 10 years ago, actually, and we're way behind, in my opinion.
Unfortunately, I've been subjected in spacesuits to a lot of technology that was not transparent.
Yeah.
And part of it was because the guys who were designing it didn't know what I needed.
Absolutely. I think that's a key takeaway message from this talk.